We continued our coverage of the ever-changing coronavirus situation on Connecticut Today for a Thursday, April 9th. We talked to a local college professor about how coronavirus cases are spiking in areas of need in communities of color. A veteran diplomat talked about diplomacy during the coronavirus crisis, including the conduct of China. We also featured the daily coronavirus update from Connecticut Governor Ned Lamont. Our first guest of the day is a professor of public health, chairs the public health department at Southern Connecticut State University. She brings to us a background in researching health disparities, including among those people of color. Professor Jean Brenny joins us. Professor Paul here at WICC. How are you?
I'm great, Paul. Thank you so much for having me on today.
And thank you for taking the time out, Professor. I guess we're starting to see some of the numbers over the past few days and start the recognition by people on all sides of the aisle that this, at least from what I've read, Professor, correct me if I'm wrong, the coronavirus thing is starting to bite pretty hard into certain communities of color.
Yes, and I want to tell you first to thank you for actually bringing this as a topic to your listeners. It is very new data. We don't have complete data yet. It is an issue that we have seen in a lot of other health conditions, a lot of other chronic diseases. So those of us who've worked with health disparities aren't necessarily surprised this is coming out. Dr. Fauci, I think, said something about it shines a light on health disparities. But what we're seeing, and the state of Connecticut is doing the best job that it can with data, is when you look at the per capita rates of who's testing positive and who's dying by race and ethnicity, you do see an uptick. You see a greater number of people of color than whites per capita, not sheer numbers. That's a different number. But the great equalizer are ratios and per capita numbers, and so that's what we're starting to see now.
So some of the reasons for this, Professor Brenny, obviously, the two big ones that I've seen are a lot of pre-existing conditions that tend to run somewhat high in these communities, and also the actual physical living setups. Is that what you've seen as well?
Sure. I think some of that is definitely what we've seen. Let me clarify a couple of things. What you are saying is true, that communities of color, specifically people who are African American and Latinx, are overrepresented among those who are infected or affected with things such as diabetes, obesity, hypertension, which of course are all chronic diseases. And we are seeing the folks who are getting tested for COVID and ending up on being intubated are those folks with these chronic diseases. So right from there, there's already a disproportionate number of people of color with getting those diseases. Now, the question then that you're asking is, why would that be? And we know what it's not. We know it's not because it's not biological, and it's not really necessarily just behavioral. It's that we know that there's a history in our country of unequal access. It's getting better. But there's been access among different communities, different racial and ethnic groups to jobs and education and safe housing and transportation. So we also see folks of color higher, more overrepresented in living in poverty, for example, or being unemployed or being underemployed, or more critically at this time, under or not insured by health insurance. So it's kind of a trend across all kinds of things. We call them the social determinants of health. These are the things like education, housing, income, transportation. And because of that, they have lower life expectancy and are more likely to get chronic diseases. So putting all those pieces of the puzzle together with COVID-19, they're going to now be, we're seeing, more likely to die from it as well as test positive for it.
As we continue to discuss the coronavirus pandemic, focusing in this segment for a few more minutes with Professor Jean Brenny, Southern Connecticut State University. She chairs the university's public health department, also an authority on disparities in health care and health access regarding the coronavirus. And Professor, you know, there's a chain in health care. I've been studying this for years, at one time a medical reporter. So from the sick person to the local doctor or maybe the clinic on up to other sorts of practitioners to all the way up to, you know, specialists and high-tech hospitals. Where do you think, Professor Brenny, is the is the beginning of the fault line here, shall we say, or the fracture in what's causing this disparity. A lot of these folks involved here, many of them don't have doctors per se at private practice. They use local clinics per se. Where does the fault line begin here?
That's such a great question. I'm so glad you asked me that question. I think there's probably a variety of the, I know you want one answer, but I think there may be more.
Oh, no, that's
one.
All right.
I think a lot of it is the way our system has been structured for healthcare in our country for so long. We have, of course, among the best healthcare system in the world, but we don't have the best well care system and not the best access to that system. As you know, most people get their health care and health coverage through their jobs, through employment. And many people are not employed. Many people are underemployed, or they work in jobs that don't have health insurance. And disproportionately, those are folks who are living in poverty or less education who tend to be people of color. So that's part of it, is a system level kind of a thing. Until that changes, until we sort of have access for everybody equally, at least in the beginning, at least for preventative care, we won't see these disparities going away. So I think that has the biggest impact on that whole sort of trajectory you were talking about. And I think along the way, oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and a lot of it, Doctor, I think that some of this is listen, every society, every race of person, every ethnicity, they also have, you know, family traditions of whether exercise is encouraged or whether, you know, healthy eating starts, right from birth or in the family unit, whether a family has access to fresh fruit and vegetables mm-hmm. every night, or whether that's just like a once-a-week thing. I mean, there's so many factors mm-hmm. to this.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're absolutely right. Would you like to come and get your master's in public health with us? You could probably teach one of our classes. You're absolutely right.
Well, thank you.
100%, absolutely. And I think that's what those are those equities. It's not just a health equity or inequity. It's sort of access inequities. And, all the things you mentioned, food, safe places to exercise, health insurance, access to education, access to transportation. I live in Hamden. I can drive my car to the grocery store. I know people who take free buses to get to the grocery store. So just having, the lack of access and just burdens like that on one's life is difficult. And if I might just also add,
sure.
in relation to COVID-19, I was listening to your show earlier before I came on, and you were talking, as I know you're talking right now from your home, and I'm in my home, and we're all working. A lot of us are working from home and social distancing. But research is coming out about a lot of folks, who are African American or Hispanic, and they're not as able to work at home as we are, who have, middle income or higher level jobs. So even there's a disparity there with the type of jobs that folks have, if they can or cannot work at home and get paid. So I think that's another aspect of this, that they haven't been able to. So some are choosing to stay in their jobs, which mm-hmm. is further exposing themselves. And then also there's just the ability or inability to practice social distancing. Some of us have taken that for granted, and that hasn't been open and accessible to everybody equally.
We are eventually going to come out of this. It's still up in the air, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, whatever. And obviously, I know folks in your line of work, as numerous other lines of work, will use this and go back and analyze things regarding this. What do you think we will learn, particularly in the issue that we're dealing with today, and as public health officials and educators look at it? What do you hope to learn about this, and what changes you think will come from this?
Well, I hope that, As I said, Dr. Fauci has mentioned, I like his phrase of shining the light. We've known this has been going on for decades. We've been working on this in public health for a long time, trying to understand how to better give people access to health care and to education and to healthy foods and all of those things, and piecemealed it together. There's nothing better than having the light shine on something on a national level that we see is broken. And I'm hoping that we can fix it if it's not state by state, but it's at the federal level to the best way that we can, that people will be able to get access and that we will be able to understand that we have been under-resourced in a lot of ways. Even though we have a lot of resources in our healthcare system, we are under-resourced. And the messaging isn't getting out equally, and the access isn't getting out equally, isn't available equally to everybody. And I think we want there to be equal access. We don't want to see these disparities. We don't want to really see any deaths, but we can't avoid that. But we don't want to see disparities in this. So I'm hoping that if we get some fixes, that we can get better access to health care for a lot of people, and just understand that this has been going on for a while, and even just an awareness of it for everybody, and to think through some things that we've been doing wrong and how we can do those better.
And maybe next time there's a congressional hearing on this about what we were warned about, Professor, for years and years, saying, you know, this will be really bad when it happens. Maybe if people just, pay attention. That might be a good idea, huh?
That would be a good start. I love that. And I do think once we pay attention, and you're right, bringing policy and advocacy to the policymakers around all of these things, you know, protections and paid sick leave. And, you know, it's amazing to me. We've done a lot of things in a short amount of time for people that we weren't able to do before. And they are these things. You know, at Southern, we have allowed people to go work from home that never were allowed to work from home before. But they're doing it and they're getting paid. And if we can do it, if we can do that in a time of crisis, why can't we do that every day when there is no crisis to just be sure our populace stays as healthy as it possibly can be? So, yeah, I'm right on board with policy and awareness and not having us go through this again.
Jean Brenney is a professor of public health. She chairs the university's public health department at Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Professor, thank you. We do appreciate the time. Hope to talk in the future. Thank you, and take care of yourself.
That would be great. Thank you. You too.
Thanks. Bye-bye. As often goes here in our wonderful democracy, or our democratic republic, I actually should say, to be more proper, there are always barbs flying out of Washington to and from some sort of ne'er-do-well country as we look at them around the world. And the rhetoric has been particularly hot against China in these past weeks. We know that. But whether it's China or Iran or North Korea or Iraq or numerous places in the world, foreign policy is still a hotly talked about issue. And should we become more realistic about what we're dealing with here? Our next guest is the Graham Stewart Professor of International Relations at Stanford University, prominent scholar, deep policy experience over decades. He was director of public planning at one time at the Department of State. He lives in Stanford, California. We welcome Professor Stephen Krasner to the show. The name of the new book is interesting. I love the title, Professor. How to Make Love to a Despot. Are we not making love, Professor, to enough of the world's despots to get along with them? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. First, thanks for so much for having me. I think our fundamental problem is we've been too ambitious. We thought we could make every country a consolidated democracy, and we can't. Either because these countries are corrupt and have ineffective institutions, or corrupt and they have effective institutions like China.
You know, in the spotlight now, Dr. Krasner, is on China. And boy, if ever there was, at least in my mind, maybe you correct me if I'm wrong, but if ever there was a country that we kind of have to have, Professor, this love-hate relationship with, or maybe love and tolerate, I guess communist China would be a good example, would it not?
Yeah, it would be. And I do think we'll have to love and tolerate. So I think if you look at American foreign policy, really from Nixon through Obama, we thought the Chinese would get richer, they'd have a larger middle class, they'd become more democratic, and they'd be just like us. And lo and behold, they remain Chinese. They're not going to change.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think that we have to recognize that China's not going to be just like us, but we're deeply enmeshed with China and would be costly for us to break those ties.
Is this, Dr. Krasner, because of the societal threads that run through these countries for not decades, but maybe for hundreds of years? Is it because we just don't understand that, or do we understand that and think we can muscle that away? Where's the bad thinking here?
Yes, I think the problem is even more fundamental than the one you're alluding to. It's true that China has had for thousands of years an effective bureaucratic state, longer than has been the case in Europe. But it's also true that the number of cases that have actually been consolidated democracies are very few. Perhaps there are 30, perhaps 35. They've been in very limited areas of the world, like Western Europe and North America. So it's not, we assume that there was a kind of natural order of things. There was a kind of end of history in which everyone would become a consolidated democracy. I think the fundamental problem is that most countries have never been consolidated democracies. And if they do become consolidated democracies, it's some combination of luck and structural conditions, which haven't existed in very many places.
And we continue to talk about the world in democracy, especially in foreign relations in this time of the coronavirus. Name of the book is How to Make Love to a Despot, an Alternative Foreign Policy for the 21st Century. Stephen Krasner is the guest, currently a professor at Stanford University, 7-plus decades in the diplomatic corps. Professor, are you at all surprised about what we are hearing or not hearing from China regarding this current coronavirus crisis? Because I think this goes beyond a medical problem here, and this does go, does it not, strain back into diplomacy and diplomatic relations?
Okay, so no, I'm not surprised. I also don't trust anything that comes out of China. And I think the problem is China is a country it's an autocratic country ruled by the Communist Party with a very effective institutional structure. They're not going to let us in. You know, Dr. Fauci recently said that the Chinese ought to close down these so-called wet markets, mm-hmm. Where they sell wild animals. But the problem is, if you look over the last 50 or 60 years, most of the serious epidemics have been diseases that have jumped from animals to human beings.
Yeah.
We're getting more and more human beings on Earth. There's not much that we can do about that.
Mm-hmm.
COVID-19, I mean, is the first instance that's really been dramatic for the United States, but it's likely that there will be others. So the best we can hope for, if you're looking at an autocratic country with an effective institutional structure, is to strengthen institutional capacity in the U.S. If you're looking at an autocratic regime with a weak institutional structure, we might be able to strengthen those institutions, but only if it does not threaten the position of autocratic leaders.
As you well know, Professor, there are people of both sides of the aisle now saying, hey, when this is all said and done, we need to reevaluate our relationship with Beijing, from, you know, the technological side of things to the manufacture of some key pharmaceuticals. Is that just political hot air, or can that be done? What do you think?
No, first of all, I don't think it's political hot air. I'm not enough of an expert to comment confidently about what it would cost us to do that, but I do think that what we should fundamentally aim for is making ourselves more resilient. That's very hard to do because you're asking politicians to spend money on something that might or might not happen, and politicians don't get any credit for spending money on things that actually end up not happening. So it's very difficult to do. I do think this is an ideal time, though, to do it.
Interesting.
So I don't think it's hot air. I think it actually makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure it will actually happen.
The title of your book, How to Make Love to a Despot, do you think that there will always be, and maybe always is too long of a word, forgive me for that, but for the foreseeable future, the next maybe 50, 100, 150 years, if we can look ahead, will there always be despots to deal with in the world, do you think? Or will there maybe come a time where the truly despotic leaders are gone?
All right, so I think there will always be despots. At least there will always be autocratic leaders. People are interested in staying in power. They're interested in making sure they have the backing of people that can wield violence, whether they have guns or spears or whatever they happen to have. And people follow their leaders. So if you look at human history, really over 10,000 years, there's really only been a very short period where we've had effective democratic regimes. We've assumed that it was easy. It's not easy. It's hard. Yeah. So what we should do with despotic regimes is aim for good enough governance. I mean, we can't eliminate all corruption, but we should eliminate the worst forms of corruption. We will not have free and fair elections in every country in the world. So I think despotic leaders, they're here now, and they're here for the long period, and we should figure out, and there isn't much we can do to remove them, we should figure out how we can deal most effectively with them.
Professor Stephen Krasner is the guest. Name of the book, How to Make Love to a Despot, an Alternative Foreign Policy for the 21st Century. Professor, let me ask you, what did you think or what do you think of the overtures that I guess are still going on between Kim Jong-un and President Trump, and the fact that the president actually stepped into North Korea, which I know made a lot of people at the State Department probably gasped and shook hands with the chairman there. What are your thoughts on that?
So I think it's relatively helpless. I think Kim Jong-un is a terrible leader, but I think it makes a lot of sense for him to have nuclear weapons. I can't imagine that the North Koreans would give up their nuclear weapons. And if there's any chance that that would happen, it would have to be China putting pressure on North Korea. And I think for the Chinese, the worst nightmare is that North Korea actually falls apart.
I think that
Trump's attempts, not that I think that all of his foreign policies have been bad, but I think his attempts to disarm North Korea have been fruitless and are likely to continue to be fruitless.
You know, Professor, I wonder when the North, when they look south and they look at the powerhouse, the economic powerhouse that another segment of the Korean people in the South have produced. I wonder, Professor, when I always read about this stuff, if Kim Jong-un and some of his right-hand men could, if they really wanted to, would say, you know what, maybe it's time to give up all this hardcore stuff. We want to make money and have nice houses and nice things like everybody else. Is it a fear, as you say, of what, say, China would do? Or do you think they really enjoy this way of life, the way they conduct themselves? Or do you think there's maybe an inkling that some of them are saying, hey, this can't go on forever?
Well, okay, so here I think is the fundamental problem. So if you look at Kim Jong-un and the people around him, they have very nice lives. They eat lobster all the time. They spend a lot of money. Most of the people in North Korea, or many of the people in North Korea, are starving. Does Kim Jong-un care about that? No. Would Kim Jong-un be better off if you had a more democratic, more effective regime in North Korea? Not necessarily. Would the people of North Korea be better off? Yes, they definitely would. But that doesn't mean that Kim Jong-un is going to change his policies. And I think Korea is a very good example, because you look at South Korea, actually it's the only country that's gone from being poor to being rich, the only country that's gone from being autocratic to really being democratic since 1945, the only country that's large, with the exception perhaps of Singapore. You would think that that would be a model for the North Koreans to follow. They haven't followed it. Why not? Because the people that are ruling North Korea are better off with the regime that they have. That's the problem.
Interesting. Finally, Professor Krasner, in the 7+ decades you've been doing this, involved in studying diplomacy in the diplomatic corps, what would you say to folks who are thinking about going into it? Maybe one of the one or two things that you really got out of it after such a long career.
Yeah. So this is, I have to say, I mean, I also have to speak to my students about this. I mean, what I would say is that we might be able to make the world somewhat better by having good enough governance. We might be able to have more security. We might be able to have better health. We might have longer life expectancies. But don't think you're going to make the rest of the world just like us.
And on that, we wind up. Great thought there. Name of the book, How to Make Love to a Despot, an Alternative Foreign Policy for the 21st Century. Professor Stephen D. Krasner. Professor, thank you. Stay well through what we're going through, and hopefully we can talk in the future. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Okay, bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Professor Stephen Krasner there.
I just wanted to go through, first of all, the daily numbers. What is interesting here? Obviously, positive cases is reflected of tests performed. I think what I found most interesting is the current hospitalized is up 46, which is a lot less than what we've seen in the past. And it continues a trend, I think the most important trend, which tells you the number of people hospitalized and what that says about trend line, what that says about capacity of our hospitals. That's good news. Positive cases by county, again, a little misleading sometimes because that can be a reflection of cases by county. Max, you're going to move that one over? Thank you. You can see Fairfield is still the highest, New Haven and Hartford. Next slide, please. This next chart we've gone over before, it's the COVID hospitalizations. Again, it's not a hockey stick, it's linear. And you can tell by the bottom line that the rate of increase in hospitalizations is not going up. And in fact, it may be going down a little bit. And what that says about the fact we may be reaching a peak. Hospitalizations by county, now we're getting more interesting. As you can see, some interesting evidence here. Most interesting to me is that top line, which is Fairfield County. And Fairfield County, as you know, was the county first hit. Probably they have a week or two ahead of, say, New Haven County. What you'll see at the top there on Fairfield County is not only is the hospitalization line flattening, it's down slightly. And I mean slightly. But the net increase in hospitalizations in Fairfield County, which was the most severely hit of our counties to date, hospitalization was down by one. That means there's one less occupied bed today than there was a day ago. And as Josh reminds me over and over again, one day does not a trend make, but it is a glimmer of hope that perhaps we're reaching a peak at in Fairfield County and what that says about the future. This next chart is interesting. It's admissions and discharges now. And you can see that, maybe you can't see, but let's say we've had 3,000 total admissions to date since we got hit by this virus about a month ago. And of those 3,000 folks that were hospitalized, went to the hospital, 1,250 have been discharged. So about 42% of the 3,000 folks that have been hospitalized to date have already come out. They're on the mend, we hope, and healing at home and last of their self-quarantining. Tragically, about 10% of the people who go to the hospital died, and that was a fatality number that we've been tracking carefully. We talked about that a little bit yesterday in terms of how it impacts different communities. Let's go to the next chart, I think. The next chart is, I really wanted to get into PPE. We talked about this yesterday, the protective gear. And what a mess it's been out there trying to get the protective gear. What this chart shows you is that we've been inundated with folks who have had access to protective gear. Protective gear being everything from the masks, the gowns. And, you know, of those 1,000 plus that were identified, a lot of them were pretty shaky, to tell you the truth. They seemed to have a friend of a friend who knew somebody in the Ukraine. But of those, we sourced 259, we validated them. We've had 20 or 30 people doing this nonstop, 12 hours a day. And we've placed 78 orders to date. And those orders are beginning to come in. Those orders are beginning to come in. Next chart, please. This tells you a little bit about what we've ordered and what we've acquired to date. You can see we've ordered about 19 million pieces of PPE, starting with respirators, N95 respirators. We got 200,000 N95 mass respirators yesterday, and those are getting distributed as we speak. And fortunately, our hospitals are also able to get a lot of their own PPE themselves. So that has given us a little bit more flexibility to get this out to first responders, nursing homes, all of our different folks in the commissions who are front-facing. We have 11,000 employees, state employees, who are still working every day, you know, be it corrections, be it mental health counselors, and others who are on the front line. And these are the folks who are making sure we're getting the PPE, the protective gear they need. And a little bit of good news. It's a sort of just-in-time inventory, I'm afraid, because we don't have much capacity, not much of a stockpile there, but people are managing their flow of PPE really well. And we went through all the commissioners this morning, and everybody has a stock, at least to keep their people safe going forward. You heard from Barbara yesterday in terms of the nursing homes, and most of them are managing their supply of gowns and masks really thoughtfully. And obviously, a few of them are not, and we're targeting them, reaching out, finding out who they are, getting them the supplies they need, and see what better protocols we can do for people. And the protocols are a broad mix. I mean, obviously, when we have COVID-only nursing homes and COVID-only correctional facilities, that saves a lot of protective gear as well, since you don't have to change it constantly as you go from non-COVID to COVID-related space. We're doing, as I said the other day, the same thing with the homeless. So I feel that we're managing our PPE really well at this point. I think that within the next week, 2 weeks, this supply of PPE that's on order, we have a high degree of confidence. Josh has a high degree of confidence. We know the orders are coming in. I know you've heard me saying today, get redirected at the last moment, but now as supply is beginning to catch up with demand, and we'll be able to get that stockpiled out to you even sooner, and then broaden the lens of people to get the PPE as well. So it's not just our first line responders, but let's say food service workers and daycare and others who are on the front line as well, and give them more protection as we see this peak going across the state on a further basis going forward. I mentioned to you that we have, you know, 11,000, you know, state workers still frontline going out there. We're going to have a terrible storm tonight. And that means we have, you know, hundreds of extra utility folks who are also working their heart out every day, getting them the gear they need just to make sure we can keep the power going for you. So this is a government, this is an economy that has to keep moving despite what you see from COVID and what we're trying to do. A couple of other touch points. Food. We've talked a lot about food. You've read some of the articles in the national press about there's some food supplies that are being constrained right now. Not as much donation of foods, not as many restaurants open to get people food. Our supply of food right now is pretty good. I'm afraid that our food share and food bank have to buy a little more of their food than they had to before. Less of it is being donated, but our shelves are stocked at the grocery stores, and we do have the food at our food share food pantry as well. I want you to know that. I know that there's such distress when it comes to, you know, food insecurity. Susan Beiswitz and our Commissioner of Agriculture were at one of the food distribution places the other day, a depot, and I was told that there were 1,000 cars lined up over the course of the day there. And that's why Lisa Tepper Bates and others are trying to get volunteers and others to help in the sorting of the food and the distribution of the food. The small business loans, I'll give you just a brief update on that. We talked to thousands of small business folks today, including our representative from the Small Business Administration. Little credit where credit's due. The Small Business Administration has been very collaborative with us. We all have some catching up to do when it comes to the technology and getting these things processed. But for our loan program, that short-term loan program is a bridge to the federal loan. We've had 5,000 applications. Several thousand will probably be accepted. We have a new fintech partner that allows us to electronically process these loans faster. And David Lehman believes we'll start getting those checks out to you over the next couple of weeks. For the federal PPE, the Paycheck Protection Program, you know, there we had, you know, thousands of Connecticut companies applied for that. Hundreds of millions of loans are being processed. They do believe those loan payments, those are forgivable loans, by the way, for small business, will start going out by the end of this month as well. And I was just reminded on the call by our representative from small business, these loans also cover you not just for payroll, not just for benefits, but also for your state and local taxes. So you'll have some protection there as well. Andy Mays, our insurance commissioner, brought up something interesting. We're fighting every day to make sure we can squeeze every dollar we can and help you survive. 50% less traffic on our roads, 50% fewer accidents, and a reduced automobile premiums going forward. So I appreciate Andy keeping an eye on that for us as well. And finally, I'll talk about dates. We had April 20th is our date where we said we'll give you notification if we think schools can open by April 20th. They can't, and Miguel Cardona is going to announce today, and I am on his behalf, that May 20th will be the new date for schools potentially reopening, at least a decision point. We'll see if we have any room between then and the end of June, as well as a small business, including bars and restaurants. I think you got to be able to count on the fact that May 20th would be the earliest that we'd reconsider opening anything. And even though we are seeing a little bit of good news, as I showed you, Fairfield County and the bending of the curve, a little more capacity at our hospitals, more PPE coming in, managing that well, I don't want us to get complacent, and I wouldn't be surprised if that May 20 date extends as well. But right now, the date is May 20. But as Miguel's going to tell you, that does not mean education has stopped. He estimates that almost every one of our school districts, most of our teachers, all of our schools are continuing learning in a variety of different ways. You know, starting in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be delivering over 180,000 reading materials, text materials, learning materials provided by Scholastic. Those are going to all of our commissioner school districts and distressed school districts to make sure those kids get the learning materials they need. That's everything from reading learning to a course curriculum. Scholastic is working with their teachers starting very soon to get them up to speed on how to use this material, both the book learning as well as the online streaming distant learning piece that's available for pre-K right up through eighth grade. As you know, we're also going to be providing the laptops over the course of the next couple of weeks and a learning curriculum for our high school students as well. We're going to have some really good news to announce in terms of free learning online curriculum for our college students, which we'll make available to you very soon. And Miguel wanted me to remind you that learning is about, you know, the reading, writing, arithmetic, but it's also about the social and emotional support that our kids need. So when we're doing online, we're also doing by telephone, we're also doing by FaceTime. Our counselors are there working with the kids in need every day going forward. So nothing would have made me happier than be able to open up the schools sooner. I'm afraid May 20th is the soonest we can possibly do, even with some of the good news we see trickling over the transom. With that, Miguel, do you want to follow up on any what I said on the schools?
Yes. Thank you, Governor Lamont. Good afternoon. I'm Miguel Cardona, Commissioner of the State Department of Education. First and most importantly, I hope you and your loved ones are in good health, both physically and emotionally. I address you now following significant reflection and consultation with public health experts and education stakeholders. To the approximately 530,000 students in the state of Connecticut, I would first like to address you directly. These are trying times, unlike any others we've seen in our lifetime. And your health and safety is our number one priority. Each and every single decision we make is happening with that safety in mind. Please remain hopeful. While the future seems uncertain right now, together we will emerge from this crisis and will gradually resume some normalcy in both our daily lives and in the delivery of your education. With that in mind, and with the close collaboration of both the Department of Public Health and Governor Lamont, the decision has been made to continue the cancellation of school classes for the next month until May 20th. at which point we will reevaluate the situation and determine if returning to the classroom this year is even possible. Please be mindful that the extension of class cancellation also pertains to all school events, including athletics and any other previously planned activities. This decision has not been made lightly, and it helps protect the valuable lives not only of our students, but of our dedicated staff and the hero healthcare workers that are working really hard to try to keep us healthy. If students are sent to school prematurely, we could be sending them in harm's way. We will not resume any school activity unless it is determined that it is safe for everyone involved, including our teachers and our students. Until that time, all efforts to provide distance learning should continue. We know we may need to cancel classes for the remainder of the year, and while we're not announcing that today, we are planning for the worst-case scenario. So to the wonderful class of 2020, you will have a graduation. You deserve it, you worked hard for it, and you're going to get it. The governor and I, along with our dedicated educators, are committed to this. All superintendents and high school principals are already planning what it might look like if classes are canceled for the remainder of the year. They're also getting direct input from high school students. I heard from high schoolers last week, and I know how important this is to you. The exemplary dedication from Connecticut educators will continue, and students, you will get your moment. If necessary, it'll be postponed until it is safe, but you deserve your moment for your years of hard work. You will get our best. I'm proud to say that our Department of Education has continued to provide guidance and support to assist students, parents, and teachers with the execution of distance learning. All of those materials are posted on the forward-facing page of our website and include resources for families and educators in supporting all students' social-emotional well-being and academic learning, including English learners and students in need of special education services. Our website includes two professional development series, one series to assist families and another series to support districts working with specific students during this challenging time. We have information and resources available in both English and Spanish, and will continue to produce more resources as needed. We will keep focusing on our students with exceptionalities and our English learners. We know we have to continue to do better. Now, to our school nutrition workers who've served over 1 million meals to date, to our administrative staff, our teachers, custodians, our paraeducators, our student and social and emotional support teams, our district leaders, and all additional district staff, I know our current situation is truly difficult to digest. What you've done in the last month has never been done before and has by far exceeded our expectations. You demonstrated to the world why you got into this profession for the students. We know you miss your students and are eager to get back with them in the school setting, but this decision has ultimately been made on a public health front with all of you and the students that you love in mind. Rest assured that I and the entire department are here to support you and continue to stand ready to provide you with the guidance and support that you need. Thank you for your service, and we're not done. With a greater sense of urgency and passion for equity and access, we will continue to educate. I'm proud to say that 100% of our districts in Connecticut are engaged in some form of distance learning, as the governor said. And I learned today that New Haven put together 1,000 packets of K to grade 2 materials for students that don't have access to technology or a computer. There's 500 packets that were created for students in grades 3 through 12 that don't have access to technology. I talked to the superintendent in Ansonia about an hour ago, who said that they've worked to distribute packets of information for students that don't have access to technology. And I know countless districts are doing the same. In addition to the 187,000 packets of instructional materials that are on their way to Connecticut to be distributed, as the governor mentioned, thanks to a donation from the Nuyi family and to the work of Scholastic. And that's in addition to the 60,000 laptops that the Connecticut partnership agreed to purchase for our Connecticut students. Thank you. I read yesterday, and it's worth repeating, virtual teaching will never replace the love, laugh, learning, and the smiles on students' faces and the aha moments that happen in actual classrooms. The quarantine is not a break for teachers and students. It's actually heartbreak. And as Ben Okri said, the most authentic thing about us is our ability to create, to overcome, to endure, to transform, to love, and to be greater than our suffering. We will get through this together. Thank you.
Thank you, Miguel. Any questions, Max?
We'll start with Sue Haig from the Associated Press.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, Sue.
Governor, regarding the PPE, you said that you are a lot of it is coming in. Did Connecticut work with other states? What do we do in order to get this stuff? Is it all just working directly with ordering it from businesses, or did you have to do something, pull some strings somehow?
Well, I'll start, and then Josh can pick up. We're working very closely with our other New England states here, helping the vet, helping the source. As you could see, most of the offers have to be, let's say, carefully vetted going forward. You see that overwhelmingly, by far, most of the PPE we get going forward is going to be what we have been able to privately purchase. And for lack of the federal government taking the lead on this, we're working on a regional basis and also directly. Josh, you want to add?
Yeah, I think, as the governor said, Sue, it's kind of all of the above. You know, we've placed several orders in collaboration with other states. We've been working through our usual distributors who candidly have not been delivering on time as committed. And so we've moved to alternate models, working with companies who have relationships with factories in China who have been generous with their time and connections to help connect us and orchestrate deals. So we've really been turning over every stone, chasing every opportunity. And as the governor said, I think we're getting close to seeing a very significant wave of PPE coming into the state. But in the meantime, as the governor said, we do have enough. We've been supplying, you know, the people on the front lines and have ensured that everybody has some supply, not as much advance lead time for the supply as we'd hope, but we're going to get to a more comfortable position soon.
And how much have we spent on this?
So of the 18.8 million units that the governor quoted, those purchase orders represent about 50 million of spend. And it's worth acknowledging that 75% of that's reimbursable by the federal government.
Thank you.
Next question from 1080 WTIC.
Guys, can you hear me?
Yes.
Mr. Governor, the two contrasting, predictions from two North American leaders. The president seems to be anxious to, as he puts it, get everyone back to work. And I'm sure he's disappointed about Easter and all that. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, said today Canadians are going to be inside for months, and he sees this going well into the summer. Where are you on that spectrum?
I want people to get back to work as soon as they can do so safely. I do worry that if we rush back to work, as some of the rhetoric has implied, you could have a second and third wave of this pandemic. So we'll be outlining over the next week or two how we carefully plan to get people back to work, antibody testing, and do it on a safe way. We're just not going to open the doors on May 20.